Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Kelly Link, who has a collection of stories, Get in Trouble. This is the fourth collection of stories, the others being Magic for Beginners, Stranger Things Happen, Pretty Monsters, which I believe was published as a young adult.
Yes.
Kelly Link is also the editor of at least 10 anthologies that I can count, and the sometime editor of a fantasy magazine of sorts, Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet. Kelly Link writes stories that more or less defy certain descriptions, much like George Saunders. You told me before you went on the air that your dad's a psychologist. These are very dreamlike. Is there any connection?
There probably is a connection. I think we're interested in theories of mind or how people construct stories about their own lives. When he was in graduate school for psychology, I was maybe in fifth grade by that point, and he gave my sister and I the test that you learn to give as a psychology student, so Rorschach blots everything. That was a lot of fun for us, but one of the things that we eventually figured out was he was giving us these tests, but there wasn't really any right or wrong answer. We'd sort of describe something back to him, and he'd say, interesting, and then he'd keep on going. And so I think that that probably does factor into how I write in some way.
Is there any connection between your actual dreams and the landscapes that you invent in your stories?
No, at least not that I'm aware of. I think, you know, apparently we forget most of what we dream. And there have been a couple occasions when I have woken up and I thought, that was a short story. That was a whole short story. I just dreamed, but I can't remember it.
I think Harlan Ellison once said the problem with trying to get a story from a dream is that dreams have their own logic. I would say that's correct, except Kelly Link's stories also have their own logic.
Well, I think there's that moment when you wake up from a dream, and in the moment of waking up, everything still makes sense. And then if you try and describe the story to somebody, you think, no, that actually makes no sense at all. The writer Howard Waldrop, who's another science fiction short story writer, describes the difference between stories that he says operate on daytime logic versus stories that operate on nighttime logic, which I think it's not quite the same thing as the logic that we understand dreams, that we interpret dreams through, but is related to it.
When you're writing, how do you let that go to be able to get to a point where you're moving in realms that don't really seem to follow the realms that most stories follow into?
I'm fairly sure that most of the material that makes me interested in writing short story comes from stories, either things that I've read. And so I think if you've read a lot and you sort of think about how stories are put together, you sort of come up with new ways to put stories together. But I'm also really interested in the ways that people tell stories about their own lives and the kinds of things that they leave out and the kinds of things that, it's not that they make up, but the ways in which they interpret their own lives or the lives of their children or of their friends.
One thing that separates your stories is that each world and each story takes place in more or less a different world, though there is one story, The Lesson, which is not science fiction or fantasy, but the other stories in Get in Trouble take place in worlds that are, to say the least, strange, incorporating multiple images, sometimes science fiction and fantasy at the same time. You said in an interview, it's a lot of fun to write a story in which everybody in the story already feels at ease with the strangeness in the story.
If you are writing a story where the fantastic intrudes into the everyday, there's sort of two directions you can go with your characters. And one is that they are really surprised by what's going on and they ask lots of questions, or maybe in fact they take it for granted. You know, that first model is a little bit like a Scooby-Doo story where, you know, people are scrambling to find explanations for what's going on. And, you know, that's kind of how mysteries work. Why is this thing happening? And who's making it happen? And what does it mean? And that's a kind of story that I don't mind reading, but it's not the way that I like to write stories.
It seemed in reading several of these stories that the reader is kind of cast adrift for the first three or four pages until you have to put the pieces together yourself.
My hope is always that the reader will be pulled into the story because the characters are interesting or because the language is doing something that's pleasurable on the reading level. But, you know, the business of the story is to explain certain parts of itself. And if you give all the explanations up front, you know, where's the forward momentum? Why does somebody keep reading?
The story Light, which is probably my favorite story in the collection, Get in Trouble, begins in Florida, which is where you grew up. It takes a while to kind of get a grasp of elements like Disney, mermaids, pocket universes. When you're sitting down to write, what's there to start? Because you've got the real story of a woman and her kind of brother, and you're dealing with, like, multiple elements. Are you just saying, okay, there's a woman and her brother?
I do think, you know, at its heart, the story is in many ways about people who have complicated relationships with their siblings. You know, your brother who shows up after being away for a while and suddenly is living in your house and creating problems for you. But that, I would say, is secondary to the things that make me want to write the story, which is I want to tell a story about a version of our world where all of a sudden there are all these sort of pockets where you can slip into other worlds, which are sort of like ours, but not quite.
She's also got an ex-husband who's kind of 7 feet tall and green and not explained in any other way.
No, he's one of the things that sort of slipped out of one of the pockets.
Well, when those things slip out, how conscious is it? You just start writing, Elliot is her husband, and, oh, by the way, he's 7 feet tall and green?
Yes. If I think, well, there are these pocket universes now that people sometimes go to on vacation. And part of it is the pleasure of thinking, all right, well, Florida is a place where people go on vacation, and it's kind of exotic to them. And so what if you, in fact, filled up a story with lots of versions of Florida that are even stranger than the one that exists and sort of begin to have all this traffic back and forth? And, you know, Florida's a city, it's a port city, and so Florida's already a place where you get a lot of really interesting things coming in, and it's a city that changes, you know, every decade, probably faster now. Very lively, sort of beautiful place with a lot of old stuff. There's a place in the story, a series of swimming pools that my dad went to as a kid that we went to as well, and I'd always wanted to put that into a story because it felt like a fantasy landscape anyway. You go swimming in these pools, spring-fed pools. There are places where you sit around and eat, and there are all these strange grottos.
Is it true that your father used to chase peacocks off the roof of his car?
It is. We lived in a subdivision in a place called Dade County, and it was maybe only half developed, and we were on the back end of the development, and past our house there was really just a lot of wilderness. And at some point there had been a peacock ranch that had burned down, you know, I think decades before they built any of the houses there. And so there were wild peacocks everywhere.
In your story, there are wild iguanas everywhere. I guess iguanas are not native to Florida.
No, they're one of those things that, you know, got imported and now has really overrun the Keys. And that, I mean, and part of the reason why I wrote this story was I visited a friend on the Keys, and there were iguanas all over her yard eating her flowers. And I love lizards. I love iguanas. When I lived in Florida, they were sort of a problem, but not to the extent that they are now.
So when you say at one point there are alien species that have invaded, and you list iguanas and Disney mermaids, one of them is actually really invasive.
Yes, absolutely. It's a place where you're very aware of the physical world around you, of the landscape, because the landscape is so interesting and things grow so quickly. And then the problem is people get in pets and let them go, and then suddenly you have thousands of iguanas all over the Keys.
That's the old story. I think Pynchon has it in the Via Gravity's Rainbow of alligators in the sewers of New York.
Which, you know, that's the kind of stuff I grew up thinking, that's amazing. That's true.
You have a ship in outer space, and we're following the ship and what's happening to it and where it's going. And then suddenly it's people sitting around telling each other ghost stories.
That story was written for an anthology that was of stories written in honor of Ray Bradbury. And there are sort of two modes of Ray Bradbury stories that I love. One is, you know, the science fiction story about the astronauts who go off on these various disastrous missions. And then the other story that he wrote over and over again were really spooky stories about bad things happening to people. And so I wanted to write a story that paid homage to some of the stylistic things he does and also incorporate both of those elements.
What you do in many of your stories, including the one about the robot boy with a ghost, it starts either as a fantasy, then has science fiction elements, or in reverse, it starts as science fiction, and then suddenly you throw in fantasy. I mean, this is deliberate on your part.
Maybe it is. I mean, I really love reading science fiction, and it is very hard to write, and so it may, in fact, be the case that I begin in a science fiction mode and then slip into a genre that's a little bit more comfortable for me. But I think what it is just I'm always trying to write a ghost story. That's the thing that I really want to do.
Do you ever worry that you cross over the line and somebody's going to sit there and laugh hysterically? You have a superhero called Man-Man who possesses the powers of Thomas Mann.
That came out of a discussion with a friend in which we were imagining pretty ridiculous superhero. I mean, superhero names are pretty ridiculous, like superhero outfits. You know, it's everything is very exaggerated or else very minuscule. You know, there's not really a lot of sense of proportion in superhero stories.
Do you ever get bothered by the fact that nobody else writes stories quite like you do?
I don't think of it that way. I mean, I think there are a lot of people whose stories are stories that I want to write stories like. I love Peter Straub. I love Karen Joy Fowler. It's a writer that we have published a couple of times, Carol M. Schwiller. And, in fact, I was in a workshop with her. We both turned in stories, and then she gave me a little speech. She said that when she had begun writing stories, she was sending them out to editors, and one of the editors wrote back and said, well, this is good, but it's a little bit too much like Donald Barthelme. And so she had never read him, so she went and she read some, and then she thought, well, then I'll do something a little bit different. And she did. And she gave this speech to me, and I think what she was saying was, stop writing stories quite like mine. And I thought, I will not. This is what I want to write.
What I notice and get in trouble is that nobody else writes stories quite like these. They go in so many different directions. I wonder if that was the reason why you had trouble getting published. I mean, you said in an interview that you always just wanted to sit there and write stories for fantasy and science fiction magazines. But when I looked at your list of stories, there was one that was published in a fantasy magazine, one that was published in FNSF, and none of the others.
One of the things that changed is there's an editor who published me repeatedly at the start of my career and still publishes my work now and then, Ellen Detlow, who was an editor for Omni and then had a couple of online magazines. And she now edits for Tor.com, but for a while she didn't have a regular magazine to buy things for. But when I started out, I think my first sale was to a magazine called Century, which was modeled after literary magazines but was made to publish genre work. And then by Ellen Detlow and by Asimov's and by FNSF. And then I sort of had a long period in which nobody wanted to publish me at all.
What kind of comments did you get back?
I got a letter sort of the second time I sent something out to Asimov's, after he had published a story by me, I got a really nice note back from Gardner Dozois, and he said, I really like this, and I would like to publish it, but it's not science fiction. And I thought, well, no, it's probably not.
I guess the great thing about being published by a mainstream publisher and not a genre publisher is that the idea of fitting you or Saunders into boxes somehow leaves you outside the boxes.
I think that the kinds of work which publishers feel that people would enjoy read has shifted. You know, you've got Colson Whitehead's great zombie novel. You have Michael Chabon writing whatever he wants to write. You know, you have Karen Joy Fowler working in different genres, and then Amy Bender and Karen Russell and all these people, you know, on one side doing stuff. And then you have a lot of people who mostly write in genre magazines who are also doing really interesting, complicated work.
It sounds as if what's happened is that the publishing industry has caught up to you and Saunders and several other people because you no longer have to be pigeonholed.
Well,
except for young adult, which
is odd because I think it's actually young adult that in some ways persuaded publishers that people still enjoyed fantasy and science fiction. I think the success of J.K. Rowling and then The Hunger Games, not just with young adult readers, with adolescent readers, but also with grown-ups, made publishers think, well, everybody seems to be on board with this. You know, maybe we can do more than we thought we could with this kind of work.
You said in an interview, mixing humor and horror is a technique for disarming the reader. When you say things like that, how conscious is the actual writing compared to looking at it afterward?
It's a little more conscious now than it used to be, and in part that's because I do a lot of teaching. So you have to look at other people's work and sort of explain things back to them. A lot of this is backwards engineering. It wasn't what I thought about when I started, but then you get asked questions and you come up with explanations that feel reasonable. But I think it is true that humor and horror are really close next door to each other, and they are things that sneak up on you. Part of it is actually pretty under the consciousness now that there are certain modes of writing that are familiar enough now that when I sit down to do it, that's just sort of what's comfortable to write. I like stuff that's funny and I like stuff that's scary, and so mixing those feels natural.
I found this in, I guess it's either an interview where you wrote this, about short stories. The ending is present all the way through the stories. If a story works, I don't think it's so much about resolution as it is about a kind of wholeness or even a kind of satisfying gap the story is organized around.
I think that the kind of stories that I most enjoy reading are stories that don't necessarily resolve, but which give you a certain kind of feeling or which you can reread. You know, it's as if the story changes from light to particle or something. On the first read through, you may feel that the story is moving in a certain direction. But when you get to the end, you think, oh, I'm going to go back and I'm going to reread the beginning again, and because I think I can read it a different way now.
So that's what you mean by the ending is present, that on any of these stories, if you go back and read the beginning, you'll see where it's going from the start.
And absolutely. I mean, I think as you write your way through a short story, it's not as if there are all these different, I mean, there are in a sense a lot of different endings that you could be aiming at, but you have to narrow down the decisions that you're making in such a way that by the time you get to the ending, it feels like a natural stopping place.
What do you mean by a satisfying gap the story is organized around? Can you give an example from Get in Trouble?
Well, sure. One of the last stories I wrote for the book is a story called I Can See Right Through You, which is kind of an example. It's a ghost story. It's a story, a demon lover story. And I think the question that some readers are going to have at the end is there, in fact, a supernatural component to this story? Is this all sort of in the head of the point of view character? And if it is supernatural, is he, in fact, in some way a manifestation of this supernatural thing? Is that whole relationship that he had with the other main character in the story, was that a natural relationship, or is there some weird sort of doubling of a supernatural story going on there? And so those are questions which I don't feel like I have to answer. I feel like I can raise those questions, and maybe the reader makes up their own mind about it, or maybe they come away and they think, who can say? You know, but my hope is that they will think, Not sure, but I'm going to enjoy thinking about it.
The same with, I guess, the Bradbury story about ghosts in space. Same thing.
What happened to the other mission, exactly.
In fact, in the very first story, the same questions could be asked. What exactly is that window a portal to? And who are the people behind the window?
Right.
You know.
Who can say?
It certainly eases the pressure at your end because, you know, you're not writing Lost. You don't have to come up with answers that people are going to be saying, hey, what is the smoke monster?
But it does mean, I think, that my work is going to be opaque and annoying to a certain kind of reader who does want a really definitive piece of information. But, you know, it's still tricky because I have to do work in the story where when I'm not answering questions, I'm still making sure that the reader does not come out of the story wanting to throw the book against the wall.
Well, there has to be some kind of internal consistency.
Has to be consistency, and I think there has to be the sense that something actually mattered, even if a question was not answered.
The story Light, even though it's got all of these pocket universes and weird stuff going on, at the center of the story is a woman and how she's dealing with her own life.
Yeah.
One final question about Light is that by the end of the story, I kept going, I want more, which brings up the question of whether you'd thought about turning any of these as you're writing them into novels or even longer stories.
Well, these got pretty long for stories. Most of them are between about 9,000 and 20,000 words. The classic length for a short story is between 4,000 and 6,000 words. Most of these stories feel, I mean, I shouldn't say most, they feel complete to me in the sense that I'm not sure that I would go back. I think a different writer could do a lot more with the material in the different stories. I think somebody else probably would write a novel about them. And I am due to write a novel, but I'm going to be starting from scratch.
Do you think that the fact that people couldn't pigeonhole you early on gave you the freedom later on to write the length of stories you felt they needed to be?
That's a good question. I went through an MFA program, which was a great program, University of North Carolina, Greensboro, straight into a genre workshop called Clarion, which is a 6-week summer program in which you write 6 stories for 6 different instructors. And the experience that I had in the MFA program was a lot of really great feedback from the other people in the workshop, but also mostly people saying, I'm not really sure what this is. This doesn't feel like mainstream fiction to me. And so I thought, well, I'm going to go to Clarion. And that was a science fiction workshop, and my experience in terms of turning in my work was, this doesn't really feel like science fiction. This is, I'm not quite sure what this is, which was a little frustrating because I thought, well, I'm writing science fiction, clearly. And I thought, well, maybe I'm not writing science fiction. People seem to be uneasy about what it is I'm doing, but they're not telling me to stop.
The story, The Lesson, not fantasy or science fiction, was this your first story that did not have those elements? I mean, it's got some strange elements, but it takes place in our world.
I wrote one story for Ellen Detlow for an anthology that she did of middle grade children's stories called A Wolf at the Door. And they were stories about villains, and they were supposed to be influenced by fairy tales. And so I wrote a story for that, which has no fantastic element whatsoever. But what I tried to do was put in as many references to fairy tales as I could while keeping it a realistic contemporary story. And that was a ton of fun. The Lesson is the second story where I've tried that, although there is a thing in that story which is not, you know, it's not a thing in the real world. There's an animal in the story, which I was really disappointed with myself. I had to come up with an animal, a taxidermied animal. And I was thinking, well, I could do a badger, or I could do a raccoon. What should I do? And nothing felt interesting enough as, in terms of animals. I just didn't like any of them. And so I invented an animal for that story. Part of the reason why I didn't want any fantastic element in that story was because I wanted it to be a story about things that are very specific to this historical moment, things that were impossible you know, 20, 30, 10 years ago. So the idea of a gay couple who are legally married, the idea of a surrogate pregnancy, the idea of a baby born at 24 weeks surviving is a relatively recent thing. You know, that when we had our daughter at 24 weeks, and she spent a year and a half in hospital, but we learned a lot about NICUs during that period and about the history of caring for premature babies. And they explained to us that the reason why the technology advanced at all was the Kennedys had a baby who was born, I think, at 32 or 34 weeks, who died. And so after that, there was this big push to make sure that that wouldn't happen again.
The spider inside the incubator? Mm-hmm. You actually saw a spider in an incubator?
I did. There's a couple of things that are pulled directly from real life. So NICUs are actually kind of beautiful at night because you're in sort of a dark space. There are all these isolates, which are what they keep the babies in when they're that little. And many of them are filled with violet light because they're sort of treating them for jaundice. And at some point I was sitting beside our daughter's bed, her isolate, and looked over, and in the isolate or incubator next to her, in this violet light, there was a spider crawling on the inside of the case. So I called over a big spider. I called over one of the nurses, and she was horrified and removed it, and then she said, "This happens every year. There's this migration of spiders," you know. And they have to deal with a lot of stuff. The other thing that I did not put in the story was a baby across from Ursula who had pooped so violently that I think the entire inside of the isolate was just, they had to sort of take it out and just sort of put it through the cleaner. And nurses have to deal with all of the weird bodily stuff that goes on, and they also have to deal with the parents who are going through really traumatic stuff.
In a sense, the lesson is also the most political story you've written.
So it's a story about a destination wedding, and the bride-to-be is waiting for her husband to show up, who keeps on being delayed, and in fact he appears to be working for probably a not very nice branch of the government, probably involved in rendition and other stuff. Yeah, and that was another thing which felt I wanted to write about, because that felt very specific to this cultural moment. And I had put in all this stuff that I sort of think of as wonderful. There's the interracial gay marriage. There's the surrogate pregnancy. There's the survival of, you know, possible survival of a baby born very early. And I thought there's a lot of really terrible stuff that goes on at the moment as well, and I need to put that in as well.
So at the same time, you do have, let's say, drifting sexuality in several of your stories.
And I think part of that is, if you are a writer, and I think especially if, for whatever reason, if you are in the science fiction community, you end up knowing a lot of people who maybe go through enormous changes in terms of orientation or identity, and who talk very openly about it. And because they're often writing science fiction and fantasy, you know, that sort of shows up in their work. So you read that work and you start to think about it, and your mind sort of gets opened to the really kind of complicated lives that people live and the hardships that they go through in order to become themselves.
When you're open on the unconscious level and you start a story, the story finds its own ending. The difficulty with a novel is the planning.
Absolutely. You're not saying anything that I'm not very, very troubled by already, and I only have a couple of small fragments of novel, you know.
Do you think that's the reason why you haven't tackled the novel before?
I think that I really love short stories, and for a long time, the ideas that I had felt like short story ideas. I didn't like the idea of tackling them as novels, because it seemed to me that they shouldn't be novels. Before my father became a psychologist, he was a minister and then worked in a seminary. And he, in fact, did not have a vocation for the ministry. You know, I will borrow that word and say I really felt called to write short stories. It really felt like what I was supposed to be doing. And now as the stories get longer, I think, well, you know, it's really dumb to keep on insisting that I don't want to write a novel, because eventually these stories are going to get up to 60,000 words, and I might as well do it deliberately rather than accidentally.
Your career began a little bit late. You didn't write at all until you were in college?
I like reading. I did not write stories until it was assigned homework. The first story was a ghost story, and I turned it into a workshop at Columbia that was being led by a writer named Raymond Kennedy. I think mostly what I felt was, well, this is great. You know, I finished a short story. This is over 5,000 words. I guess this is a thing that you can do. Got good feedback on it and did some revising and then wrote a couple of more stories for that workshop. And I wouldn't say that I enjoyed writing, but I enjoyed the aspect of writing that is problem solving, just in figuring out how to make things work, that it is annoying and tedious, and yet there's a joy in thinking, now it works.
Which one did you send out first?
I didn't send stories out until I was in graduate school. And in fact, I really didn't send stories out until the end of graduate school. And I think in part that's because MFA programs very rarely are focused on the business of publishing. And I'm sure people do actually submit while they're in graduate school, but they don't really talk about it much. You know, you're there to write and talk about writing. You're not there to sort of think about a career. So I didn't send stories out until pretty late. One of the terrific things about Clarion was that, as well as having six instructors come in and give you different perspectives on writing, everybody talks about writing as a career. They're all professional writers. They all are very generous in discussing with you how you make a career of writing. It's not that they explain to you how to make a lot of money writing. They just talk about it as a career. They give you a lot of practical advice.
Kelly Link, your first collection was self-published. What happened? Had you sent it out, or did you decide, I'm just going to do this?
By that point, I had published most of the stories in magazines. And I had not sent it out because I knew that people didn't really publish short story collections. But a friend who ran a very small press approached me and said, I could pay you $500 and publish it. And I said, well, let me write a couple more things. And I did, and I gave them to him. And he said, I don't like these. And so I thought, well, I do. I wouldn't want to leave these out. And so I bought the collection back. By that point, a couple of editors asked if I would send in the collection. And each time they wrote back and they said, we really like these short stories, but we can't publish collections, which I knew, which is why I had not sent them in the first place. Do you have a novel? And I said, no. By that point, Gavin and I, my husband now, we were publishing a zine twice a year. We knew a lot of people who worked in publishing, including the guy who ended up not publishing my collection. And they talked about publishing all the time and about small press publishing. And so I think eventually we thought, well, we know enough people that if we decided to do this, we could get some really great advice. And it did seem to us that there was a gap in publishing, that people didn't like publishing collections. And we thought, well, maybe we could do that. So we started with my collection and with a collection by a writer named Ray Vuksevich called Meet Me in the Moon Room, a writer whose work I really loved. And he was very brave. We emailed him or wrote him and said, would you be interested in publishing a collection? Even though he had no idea who we were, you know, he said, why not?
Your collection was Stranger Things Happen.
Yep.
Was Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet, was that the zine you're talking about?
Yep. Gavin liked the idea of publishing a zine, although I think he's a science fiction reader, but his model was really much more the personal zine or the music zine. A lot of the stuff coming out from people working as dishwashers or writing about comics or writing about music. I know that there's a very long tradition in science fiction of fanzines, but that wasn't his thing. So he sort of recreated, I think, something that's been going on in science fiction for a very long time, but more modeled on sort of the punk rock scene than this SF one.
And that was a zine in real copy.
We still get it photocopied at the local printer.
Do you have it online as well?
Parts of it are online. But no, I mean, it really is about the physical object more than anything. There are online subscribers. You can, you know, get an e-subscription. But there's a physical magazine we print. I don't even know how many now. Sometimes people do the chocolate subscription. So every month we send the magazine and the chocolate bar.
Your second collection, Magic for Beginners, that was also self-published?
Yes. And that time around, people, again, asked to see it, and nobody wanted it. One publisher made one offer, which we couldn't take because we'd already sold foreign rights, and they wanted foreign rights. So, yeah, we published it in hardcover. Then an editor at Harcourt out in Mifflin bought it in paperback.
Pretty Monsters, that was published as young adult because?
Well, because I read a ton of young adult. Many of the stories in Pretty Monsters were originally written for young adult anthologies, and I really wanted a collection which was, you know, sort of pulled those stories together. It included three stories from the first two collections as well that felt like young adult work.
What is three zombie stories? An Harvard Bookstore on-demand book?
Harvard Bookstore has a print-on-demand machine that you can get anything downloaded from Project Gutenberg, or writers who are self-publishing can print up copies of their book, perfect bound. The machine is called Page M. Gutenberg, and so you can watch your books being made. There are a couple of writers, including Steve Almond, who have published their own chapbooks through it, and I really wanted to do something with that machine. I love the Harvard Bookstore. I had three zombie stories, and I'd always wanted to call a book, I don't know the author or the title, but it's X, because when I did work in a bookstore, people came in all the time and said, I'm looking for a book. I don't know the author or the title. And so it always seemed like that title itself would be a great title.
Right now you're the owner of Small Beer Press, which comes out of Massachusetts. How many books do you guys publish?
Between 6 and 10 books a year. We're probably more of a micro press than a small press. A small press would be maybe Coffee House, which does a lot more books than us.
And the distribution is handled?
By Consortium, who handles a lot of really terrific presses, Grey Wolf and Coffee House and $2 Radio, which is a terrific small press.
Kelly Link, now that you're becoming better known, has Hollywood come calling at all?
I've had people option a handful of stories. A couple of times I've gotten to see scripts. I think one story got as far as they found a location, and then maybe the funding. I think something happened with some of the funding. I mean, the thing about movies is that I think the director probably has to feel pretty personally attached to the material, and I think many times they're people who have their own stories. So it seems pretty unusual to me that somebody needs to go out and acquire a story when they have their own stuff to do. I love the idea of somebody buying a story and making a movie out of it, and I'm not interested in, you know, something being adapted into another medium and staying faithful. I just want it to be good. So whatever has to be done to make it work in a different medium is fine. We released Stranger Things Happen under the Creative Commons copyright, and so there have been some adaptations into animated films, or in one case a composition, I think, for cellos, and some paintings, things like that, which has been really fun.
Let me ask you about graphic novels. I can't read them.
Really?
I get them occasionally in the mail, and I look at them, and I can't read them. I mean, I was a comic book fan when I was a kid, teenager, in my 20s, but I find I cannot read a graphic novel.
Huh. I do like graphic novels, although I read a lot less than I used to. And oftentimes, you know, there's a disparity. You know, I will like the art but not the story, or vice versa. I really like a comic book right now called Saga, which is an ongoing story. And I have been reading the bind-ups, the collections, rather than the issues, because I'm old and I don't go to the comic store as much anymore. And, you know, on the day that the comic book comes out, and pick it up.
Kelly Link, you want a sweepstakes.
I want a free trip around the world. I was a student in Scotland for a year. I did a JYA, and the student travel STA used to be all over the place. Was running a competition where you had to answer three geographical questions, and then there was a tiebreaker, which was, why do you want to go around the world? And I wrote, because you can't go through it, and apparently they thought that was funny, and they gave it to me.
Did you go around the world?
I did. I went to Indonesia and Thailand and New Zealand and Fiji, and ended up back in England to visit friends. I had a year to do it in, and I used that free trip to fly back to the U.S. from Scotland, and then went west after I graduated from college, and then eventually ended up in England and had to make my way back. My mom, when I won the trip, I called and I told her, and she said, "This is probably the best thing that will ever happen to you." And I thought, maybe.
Kelly Link, you mentioned before a novel. One thing that I discovered in doing this show for many years is the latest thing is for a publisher to buy a short story collection and then demand a novel. The idea is, we'll publish your short story collection if you write the novel. Yeah. And that's basically what happened with you?
No, it was a little different. When I had these stories pretty much in order, my agent went out with the collection, and I went and met with a bunch of different editors. And when I said, "I'm thinking about writing a novel," they were all very cautious. They all said, "Well, you don't have to. You know, you should really think about that pretty hard." I sort of feel the same way. You know, I did think that I had to go away and think pretty hard about whether I wanted to write a novel. I wanted two things. I wanted to find a publisher and an editor that I wanted to have a career with. And I sort of thought, well, this is my chance to sort of find a home for the kind of work that I want to do. And I thought it would be great if I had a second project lined up with them, and I do really want to write a novel. And in fact, Noah Eaker at Random House bought this collection. He bought the novel that I'm going to write, and he bought rights to Magic for Beginners. So that feels very solid.
You realize, of course, that these days a novel could be almost anything, including linked short stories.
Well, that's always been the case. And here's the thing about, there's a piece, and I'm trying to think where I read it, talking about how, you know, the short story was sort of more, is sort of treated as a more valuable form in science fiction. And, you know, they sort of talked about how in mainstream literary fiction, you get these novels that are sort of cobbled together. And that's not true. There are tons of fix-ups in science fiction. It's actually a term that comes out of science fiction is the fix-up novel, which is a novel made out of short stories that people sort of began putting together in the 50s and 60s.
Foundation by Isaac Asimov.
Right. I mean, a lot of the classic science fiction novels are, in fact, fix-ups of short stories that were published one by one. And then on the other side, I mean, you have books like Olive Kittredge, or you have Girl's Guide to Hunting and Fishing, to name a sort of older example. It's not the kind of book that I want to write, but it is a book that I've enjoyed reading. It's an interesting structure. There's something episodic about fix-ups, and I don't want it to feel episodic. I want it to move, you know, at sort of a certain speed.
In your stories, I noticed they're all single point of view stories.
Hmm.
Some of them are first person. They're all pretty much, if I can recall correctly, present tense.
I know there are a lot of present tense stories in the collection. I made a chart when we were sending out the collection, in which I sort of went through the different attributes of the different stories. You know, is the narrator male or female? What's the age of the, what's the general feel of the piece? What kind of irresolution is there at the ending? Because they mostly don't resolve. Because when we were ordering the stories, I didn't want to put stories that felt too similar together. A lot of stories in the book where people drink a lot. And so I had to think about, did I need to space those out? You know, the locations of the stories, where are the stories? Just to keep stuff in the right order. But what I don't think I made a note of was either, you know, one point of view or multiple or even tenses. I don't think I thought about tenses at all, which is interesting.
You've been listening to an interview with Kelly Link, whose short story collection is titled Get in Trouble. The best way to get her other books, including the self-published one, is to go to her website, kellylink.net. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.